Welcome to season 4 of my podcast, Between Us, Stories of Unconscious Bias. I've added the title Between Us, as I thought stories of unconscious bias alone was a little too remote. My hope was that the podcast would feature honest and personal stories that raise awareness and educate. Between Us, as a main title, underlines the intimacy while reinforcing the sense of our collective involvement. Since launching it in early May 2020, the world has again changed. George Floyd died, and Black Lives Matter, which had started in 2013, has become more popular and more widely accepted. Identity politics and culture wars have deepened in the UK and the US. Meanwhile, in other countries, people are being marginalized for their religion and beliefs. The need to understand the subject of unconscious bias has taken on ever more meaning and resonance. As always, I am so grateful to all my wonderful speakers who share their often brave stories and allow us to understand the nuances of this very important subject. Thank you for listening. I'd like to introduce Habib Akande. Habib Akande is a sex educator, author, and historian. His work explores an ancient African sexual practice for women's satisfaction, which he believes can close the gender pleasure gap. His work also covers race relations and sexual intimacy in Brazil and Muslim cultures. Habib is the author of the Amazon best-selling book Kunyaza, The Secret to Female Pleasure, which was featured in the Orgasm Gap documentary by the BBC. Habib aims to present a positive representation of African cultures and sexually empower women with culturally competent sex education. So already, before Habib has even said a word, all of you listeners are thinking, hang on a minute, there are so many conscious and unconscious biases in this introduction. And you may be thinking, Habib is going to be dismantling so many different assumptions that many of us may have, either about sexual practice, or about Brazilian cultures, or Muslim cultures, or perhaps just about women's satisfaction. I don't know. But I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say. So Habib Akande, thank you so very much for joining me to share your stories, Between Us, Stories of Unconscious Bias.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Smita. I'm very looking forward to this conversation.
So Habib, I'd just like to know, you know, we said we're going to talk about unconscious bias. What do you understand by that?
Where do I begin and where do I end? Like when I think of unconscious bias, a number of things come to my mind. Whether it's implicit bias, stereotypes, preferences, social stereotypes, all sorts of things. But I think it's something which is implicit in what obviously the term is unconscious, is something that you don't really think about. So it's something that, again, we've all been shaped by our culture, our environment, what have you. And that's created some prejudices that we all have. And some of them are fair and some of them you could argue are unfair. And I think that ultimately is maybe what I think about when I think about unconscious bias, as something that's in my subconscious or that's implicit in my way of looking at people or behaviours, and it's something that I'm not really consciously aware of.
That's fair enough. And so what does that look like then in real terms? Because obviously with the kind of work that you're doing, yes. You're based in London, if I'm not mistaken, but you work in, I mean, right now you can't go anywhere because of COVID-19, but when given the opportunity, you work in Brazil, you work in various African countries and so on. So I would love to hear some stories from you about your experiences and understanding of unconscious bias.
Sure. I'll be more than happy to share some stories. I mean, with understanding my own unconscious biases, as well as trying to understand other people's and trying to unravel that with some of the work that I'm doing, it's always an interesting challenge because as much as, like, for example, my work in studying race or studying sex and sexuality in different cultures and continents, I get to the stage where I think that I'm, not that I don't have any biases, but I'm aware of my biases, and then I'm met with certain stories or people that makes me question and challenge my own biases that I hold. I'll give you an example of that is my recent travel to Brazil. I've been to Brazil about 6 or 7 times in the past, like 5 to 6 years. And it's something which, going to Brazil, I found the people very friendly. I've never really felt in danger of my life or anything like that. And when I've been giving presentations, I'm in the UK, and I gave one in the United States, I think about 2017, 18. And a number of people asked me, particularly women, about what is it like for the experiences as a woman in Brazil. And I said that, from my impression, especially in Salvador, which is in northeastern Brazil, the people are generally friendly. As long as you don't go out wearing, jewelry or things like that, I don't think your life is in danger. But that was, again, my experiences. And then I was challenged by a number of women in the audience, and they said, "That's because you're a man." And maybe the male in me was like, "No, that's just because Brazilians are friendly people." And then I listened to what the woman had to say, and she explained that she's been a number of times and she doesn't feel safe in certain parts or certain areas. And one of the reasons maybe why our experiences probably differed was because obviously me being a man, I'm not maybe seen as much as a threat as maybe a woman would be. And also the sexual harassment that she said she was and a number of friends were subjected to. And then when I went back to Brazil after that encounter, and then I was actually actively listening and watching the experiences of women, tourists, and even Brazilian women, then I got a total different perception and total different reality. So that was like, that's like an example of an unconscious bias that my experience was one where I didn't feel threatened. I felt the country was really safe and I can go out in all different times of the night. But then someone else is telling me they had a very different experience in that space on, their gender and something which again maybe I had a blind spot and I wasn't aware to. So again, I just think with unconscious bias is something that I'm always trying to challenge myself and how I view the world because naturally I'm viewing the world from my obviously two
Exactly,
eyes.
exactly. I mean, and that's just it, isn't it? Because we all, whether it's you in Brazil or me in somewhere else, it doesn't matter. I mean, the story you've given is a great example of how any one of us anywhere in the world will view the world from our eyes. That's just what we do, and that's what unconscious bias is about. You know, we have our stories, our narratives, and therefore we make assumptions based on how we see things. And you see it obviously from the male eye and the male gaze because you are a man. And you travel by yourself and you've traveled, you know, vastly around the world, you've never had any problem. But it's only when you start connecting and hearing other people's stories, you realize, of course, not everyone can have the same idea and experience as you. I like that. But tell us some more. Give us some more stories, Habib.
I'll give you another story. I'll give you so this was in I think around 2017. I was invited, or 2016, I was invited to an academic conference in France where I had to give a presentation about the history of erotic Arabic literature dating back from the 9th century to the 16th century. Now I submitted my presentation and I was in touch with the organizers and they and I also wrote a book along those lines about sexuality in the Arab world. So they're familiar with my work, they liked my presentation, they invited me for this 2-day conference in France. So when I went there, obviously I'm a black man, not that tall, but I look quite young for my age, but I'm in my mid-30s, but I could pass for maybe my early 20s on a good day. So when I went there, the person at the university, they were asking me what my hair for. So when I told them who I was, I gave them proof of ID. They looked at me questioningly and was thinking, I can't be one of the people that's giving the presentation because it was an academic conference. The person went to me superior, and then I can obviously I don't understand French, but I can tell that they were like questioning, like this can't be right. And then their superior also actually checked with someone else, and then they had to get the organizer, the person I spoke to, who had to come to the front and actually admit me into the conference to speak. And it was something which she kind of dismissed it and said it flippantly, like, oh, that's just them being ignorant. And then after I wanted to ask why, I thought I just wanted someone else to confirm, why do you think that they kind of that was that pushback? And she said probably because of you're black and they wouldn't expect some a black person, especially in France, to be given a presentation when it's full of academics and professors and what have you, and you looking like, not that I was scruffy look or anything, but it just for a lot of people, it just went over their head to find a black person speaking at an academic conference. So that's for me, that's an example of an unconscious bias that maybe because I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt, because maybe they're not used to seeing black people in those spaces. And to be fair, I was the only black speaker out of maybe about 60 people from different parts of the world. And even for the delegates and the attendees, maybe there was a handful of black people out of the 300 odd people that attended over the 2 days. So again, maybe because in generally in these type of conferences or these type of spaces, they're not used to seeing black people, let alone a black person as a presenter, they probably couldn't believe it. And they that was maybe some of their biases, which someone could say it's racist, what have you, but I've come across similar experiences like that in my both my professional world as well as in my work as a writer and as an independent researcher giving presentations. So and some of it, again, I try and understand where the person's coming from. It's like a lot of times they're not used to seeing a black person, like I said, in these types of arenas. I even had a similar experience with a publisher that I was working with that was communicating for a period of time, obviously online. They didn't know what I looked like. When I had the first meeting, they were shocked. And they even said, I thought you was, it wasn't a bias based on my ethnicity, it was my age. And
Right.
they ended up saying, I thought you was like in your like mid-40s. And that was when I was in my early 20s when I published my first book. So that was like another example, because the expectations was for someone to write the book that I proposed, I would have been not well advanced, but at least in my late 30s or early 40s. And we kind of had a
So
laugh.
let's look at a couple of these things that you've just mentioned, because you tell me that part of your work covers race relations and, of course, sexual intimacy. And I want to kind of maybe keep them separate, I don't know. But when you're doing your research and your work, what does that mean when you're saying your work covers race relations and sexual intimacy and in Brazil and Muslim cultures? Now, in that one sentence, which I have just read out again for your introduction, to me, there could be a lot of assumptions that people will make when they hear that. When they might make assumptions about Muslim cultures and sexual intimacy. They might make assumptions about race relations and Brazil. Or they might, and that's for me the very obvious comparisons in my head. But you've obviously done work there. You've gone to Arab countries or perhaps North African countries. I'm not sure where which countries you visited that are predominantly Muslim. And of course, you've been to Brazil. So tell us a little bit more about your experiences in these areas and what your work looked like and what kind of challenges you might have had in terms of unconscious bias.
Sure. So originally I'm from Nigeria. Obviously born and bred in the UK. After I graduated from university, I lived in and studied in Egypt for 3.5 years. And that's where I wanted to learn a bit more about Arabic and Islamic religions. And that's where I encountered a lot of hostility towards black people and anti-blackness and racism. And for me, I wanted to understand, I'm in a Muslim majority country, I'm studying with Muslims, and why is that there is this, and where did this stem from, this anti-blackness, racism, or this unconscious bias, however you want to call it, to black people. And it was, and there's numerous stories I can give, like when I, if I was walking, and happened to a number of black people in Egypt, people would, Egyptians would look at their hand and they'll say, Kamsa'a. In Arabic, meaning what time is it? They ask you what time is it, pointing at their hand. You look at your hand and they start laughing. And that's a joke in parts of Egypt where you looking at your hand and you're seeing your brown skin is reminding you of your blackness, and they found that funny.
Oh,
So
right.
yeah. So for me,
And
that was just
just
like,
to, for the context of this conversation, can I ask you what is your practicing religion, or if you
Oh,
have
I'm a
one?
Muslim. Yes, yeah, so I'm a Muslim. So
Okay.
for me, it was quite shocking that I'm with people that practice the same faith, but I know my religion doesn't teach like racial inferiority or superiority. So I was baffled by it. So I wanted to understand the history of where did this anti-blackness or this racism towards black people, where did it emanate from? And that's what led me on to my independent research and publishing my first book, trying to understand race relations in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, and understanding that this didn't just derive from the Europeans, because many people, especially in the Muslim world, would like to blame the Europeans and colonization as if they brought racism, when there were examples of anti-blackness and anti-black racism in the Arab and Muslim world prior to the Europeans coming into the Muslim world. So that's something that, and there were a number of Muslims, Arab Muslim writers who spoke about anti-blackness and trying to address their people about this is not something which is befitting of a person of faith as far back as the 16th and 15th century. So that's what led me to kind of wanting to understand race relations and why. Different parts of the Arab Muslim world that black people kind of seen in some quarters as being somewhat inferior, and black women were seen to be less desirable as marital partners.
So this
And
is very
then
interesting because I'm just trying to capture what you've said here. So you're saying that in some parts of the Arab Muslim world, around the 15th, 16th century, before there was anything that you and I might know as colonization happening in those countries, there was already what we can call specifically colorism for the local, say, Egyptians, as an example that you've given, against people who are black? So, I mean, to be perfectly honest, from where I'm sitting, they're all different shades of brown. But for the context of this conversation, let's go with what you're saying. So you're black, the Egyptian is brown, and therefore lighter skinned than you are. And there is racism towards people who look like you in the 15th century. Is that what you're saying?
As far back as the 9th century, the 15th and 16th century, there were a number of books written. Even as far back as the 9th century, there was books written by Arabs about the virtues of black people and to encourage people not to discriminate against black people. And they wrote those
books. So what's that about? I mean, what can we learn from that, Habib, in relation to unconscious bias? What kind of stories do they have? Because I'm always curious to learn more. Where did that come from?
Yeah, I think it comes from where power lies. So when we're speaking about even in the, not only in terms of racism, but in terms of like the concept of beauty and who we consider to be beautiful and desirable, that's obviously subjective. We know beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Now, if the people in power are predominantly Arabs, and this is maybe their beauty ideal, and maybe their beauty ideal for a lot of the early Arabs was maybe like a Persian woman who's very pale in complexion, dark black hair, dark long black hair and black irises, anything that was maybe opposite to that was maybe considered to be less desirable. Now, if you're taking that standard of beauty, then obviously you're looking at it from the perspective of someone who doesn't fit that standard of beauty, then obviously they might view you as to be less desirable or inferior. But again, if you were to go to West Africa, where the standard of beauty may be a very dark-skinned black woman that maybe even might have short hair, the opposite might be considered to be less desirable. And that's something that I've realized when I've traveled to different parts of the world, whether I'm in Egypt, whether I'm stayed in Saudi Arabia for a period of time, in parts of Brazil, everyone has got different standards of beauty. Everyone's got different understandings and concepts in terms of what they consider to be superior or preferable or favorable. Now, if the people that are in power are the ones that also are documenting things and writing books, then that's going to be reflected, or like in the modern world, controlling the media, that standard of beauty, even though it's from one part of the world, is going to be reflected as if this is the mainstream dominant standard of beauty.
Makes absolute sense, and
that's basically what it is. So it's where the power lies. And that continues today
anywhere in the world.
Yes. And that's something that I've, even in my studies, looking at sex and sexuality and intimacy. I'll give you another quick story.
Please.
You mentioned earlier about my latest book was looking at an ancient African tradition, which is focused on female pleasure. And it's originally from Rwanda in East Central Africa, where they have a tradition of celebrating female ejaculation, commonly known as squirting. It's something that is praised and is spoken about for centuries. But in the Western world, it's not really taken seriously because, and I'm talking about Western academics and Western sex researchers, it's this idea that because Africans are seen as inferior and they haven't contributed intellectually to anything that they regard as intellectually worthy in sexual studies, the experiences and the testimonies of African women and black people speaking about this practice is often dismissed. So when, for example, if people are going to speak about the history of sex and sexuality, it's got this, it's like it started from like maybe like the Kama Sutra, then you had the ancient Romans and Greeks, then you had years later, you had maybe the Taoist tradition, then you also had the Western psychologists who discovered the G-spot. And even that's problematic, the fact that we have European men or female body parts are named after European men, because this idea that like the G-spot was named after Ernest Grafenberg in the 1950s, the fallopian tube, again named after a man, so the Skene's glands. And this is because the Europeans have done a very good job of documenting their findings, but it's new findings to them. They'll document it and then it's disseminated across the world as if this is the standard for everyone to adopt. And anyone that might have quote unquote discovered this prior to the Europeans are dismissed. So when I've written proposals for some sex journals about my research, about like the Kunyaza tradition and Eastern Africa and their practices and their understanding about sex and sexuality, many a times they don't want to hear it unless I'm speaking about female genital mutilation.
Pause there a minute, because I would, first and foremost, what you just said is so right, because when most people are thinking of Africa and sexuality in any way, they think about female genital mutilation. Yeah. But let's put that aside for the moment. Could you explain, because you said it very, very briefly, could you explain again to us, the listeners, What is kunyaza?
Sure. So kunyaza is a non-penetrative sexual practice which involves, excuse me, a heterosexual sexual practice which involves the man using his penis to stimulate the clitoral gland and labia minora in a tapping or rubbing motion, where he doesn't insert his penis into the vagina, but he basically uses his penis to stimulate the clitoral glands and labia minora. And it's said that it can help facilitate female ejaculation and or orgasm. One of the interesting things about this practice itself, the practice itself is not actually revolutionary, but it's the fact that it focuses and emphasizes the importance on clitoral stimulation. And there's many studies recently that's come out in the West that most women experience an orgasm via, or the most effective route to experience an orgasm is via clitoral stimulation and not by intercourse, that most women do not regularly orgasm via intercourse. And this is something which the West has kind of proclaimed as this is like groundbreaking that they've discovered, when you have many practices and traditions that wasn't focused on clitoral stim and focus on penetrative intercourse. And the kunyaza tradition is one example where men
And
are
this was
taught.
when? Which year are we talking about that the
Hundreds of
kunyaza
years ago,
tradition
sure.
was prevalent?
It's been practiced for hundreds of years. It's but it's
Hundreds
an
and.
oral, yeah, hundreds of years. It's an oral tradition that's been practiced and it's been taught from mother, women will teach young girls and young women before they get married, and they're known as sengas, or like sex educators. And also, you've got the men in the community who also will teach boys and men about the female anatomy prior to marriage. So this was considered to be a sacred practice. And there's an ancient kunyaza legend or story. In terms of the legitimacy of the story, I'm not too sure how accurate it is, but the story goes that in ancient Rwanda there was a queen who was she was missing her husband, put it that way, and she was seeking to yearning for intimacy. She summoned one of her guards to make love to her. The guard initially refused, and he was worried because of the consequences if the king were to come. Then she ordered him that, you must make love to me. And as he, again, this is how the story is told, as the guard made his way towards the queen, he was holding his manhood and he was shaking. And as he was shaking and trembling, that his penis was knocking and hitting against her labia minora and clitoral gland, which is known as the magic bean. And from there, it was told that a gush of fluid emanated from her loins. And from there, that's how the kunyaza tradition was formed. And then when the king came back, the queen then told the king, "This is how I want you to stimulate me, and this is how I want us to make love." And then that's how that tradition has been taught from generation to generation. Now, the actual story itself, and it was said that her gush was so fluid and copious that it formed Lake Kivu. Now, that's probably a myth, but it's a nice story to tell.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's refreshing about it is that it's a story that focuses and emphasis on, and how kunyaza is taught is that the man is there to try and make sure that his female partner feels pleasured and is pleasured, and it's
Which is
focused and
that was
it's
the
not
point I
penetrated.
was also going to make. Because number one, that many hundreds of years ago, we were celebrating how a woman does get sexual pleasure in Africa. And number two, which I find in some ways even more important or equally important, the fact that men were told, this is not just about, obviously being of Indian origin, I know of the Kama Sutra, where it was very much a book written for men to know how to pleasure women. But you're saying this has been happening in Africa as well. So why is it that we don't know about these things? Is this where colonization comes in? What's the story behind
Yeah,
this?
colonization does come into it. So when Rwanda was colonized by a number of the Europeans and they came across the kunyaza tradition, they were told that this is a barbaric practice. It's not something that is something which is in line with the Christian faith. And that's why even now to today, kunyaza is not as widely practiced as it was previously. So it's only practiced in rural areas, and but it's still maintained through oral traditions. And I wanted to kind of preserve. When I heard about this fascinating practice and the culture behind it that is pleasure positive and it's mainly focused on female satisfaction, I wanted to document this practice and hopefully so it can hopefully lead to more studies not only about the kunyaza practice but African traditions and female ejaculation, because it's something that in the Western world, unfortunately, there's a lot of stigma around women's sexual women's body parts, women's sexuality, whereas you don't really get that with men. It's like if a man were to say these are experiences, it's accepted. Whereas many times when women are speaking about their experiences, it's always questioned. And if you were to like type in terms of sexual studies, about female ejaculation, squirting, whatever you want to call it. It's always a question of, does it exist? Is it real? Is it fake? And despite that, there are hundreds of women, if not thousands, giving their own testimonies that this is an experience that they a legitimate experience, but for whatever reason, many times it's dismissed because, again, this idea that women aren't capable to speak about their own experiences, and they're believed without it being validated by either a man or by quote unquote science, which is science is subjective, you know.
So how has this worked for you, Habib? Because you are traveling to these countries and you are researching, but here is this man arriving there to question and get stories. Is that how you've been doing the research? And how
No,
has that worked in terms of unconscious bias?
that's a very good question. So even when I've been undertaking my research, and I'm originally, like I mentioned earlier, from Nigeria, which is in West Africa. So the Kinyasa, I mean, the Rwanda is very, the culture is very different. And even when I was speaking to a number of both Rwandan women and men, and Ugandan and Kenya, because also practice in those neighboring countries, there was a little bit of hesitant and reluctance from some people to speak to me about this practice, because some people view that I'm from the white man's, word for word, this is what people said, you're from the white man's land. I hope you don't misinterpret us or speak ill of our tradition. I said, no, I just really want to hear about the practices, and I want to document it because I haven't come across a book in English about the practice. And I think it's very fascinating, not just the practice, but the culture surrounding it. So there was pushback, like I said, from some people because I'm from the UK. And there's some people that, because they saw me as like their African brother, they were able to, they felt comfortable to, I think, what was it called again? Is it affinity bias? They were like in a form of affinity bias, but they felt because they could relate to me because it was from the motherland, so to speak, that they were able to share their secrets. So I had two examples, and some women that naturally didn't feel comfortable speaking about this intimate topic and sensitive topic with a man, which I do appreciate and respect it. So I did experience both unconscious bias and also maybe you could say affinity bias, where people felt comfortable to
What
open
about
up to me.
language, though? Were they speaking in English? Do you speak any African languages? How did that work?
Yeah,
Or did you
that's
have an interpreter?
no, I didn't. Fortunately, I mean, there are a number of, there was a documentary that came out in 2016, which spoke about the Kinyasa practice, and I spoke to the director. He's French, Belgian, but he speaks English, and he put me in contact with a number of English speaking Rwandan people. So there's a
That was
Rwandan
helpful.
sexologist. Yeah, so that helped. So that helped.
All right. So, I mean, this is utterly fascinating, Habib, and you've obviously had some fascinating, unusual, and very interesting experiences. Just a quick question before we move on from the Kunyaza story. What religion are they, the Rwandans who practice Kunyaza? Or do they have a religion? Because it's so many hundreds of years ago, perhaps there wasn't even a formal religion. I don't know.
Yeah, the majority of people in Rwanda are Christians, but you also have some Muslims as well who practice the Rwandan practice. So, and what's interesting about the practice and people that adhere to it, they see it as a cultural practice rather than, so irrespective of whether you're Christian or Muslim or what have you, they look at it as a cultural practice. But there are some people, because of their religious views, like there are a couple of Christians I spoke to who felt that the practice isn't befitting of Christian women or Christian man. So again, maybe because of their religious values and beliefs, informed why they view the practice as positive or negative, but it's generally kind of can seem to be a cultural practice, irrespective of the religion of the people in Rwanda.
So when you started out, doing the research and exploring these ideas of female sexual pleasure and possibly religion, did you go in with any kind of assumptions, unconscious biases that, oh, in such and such place it'll be like this, or the other way around? I'm just curious to know whether you had any surprises while you were researching.
Because from my first, like, looking into like sex and sexuality was looking at from the Arab, in the Arab world, in Muslim majority countries, and I know that there's a lot of, it's a taboo topic, and not many people are comfortable to speak about it and understand it. I know there's going to be a lot of, I try to go into it with an open mind, and just try and understand it, because not everything I necessarily agree with, because I've got my own biases myself. But I just try and understand, number one, where why people behave the way they do, or why they view certain practices to be appropriate or inappropriate, and then try to understand where they're coming from. Not going there with a judgment-based view. It's more a case of me trying to understand. So I try and put my although it's impossible because I've got biases, but I try and put my biases aside somewhat. But it's more a case of, if anything, the biases that I go in with is I'm looking for pleasure positive or and female pleasure positive practices, because there's enough practices that speak about the importance of women satisfying their male partners, why men are superior, and all the rest of this. So for me, I wanted to find where I come across any practices or cultures which is more, you could say, positive or female affirming. I'm more interested in that because, again, that's quite unusual. So I try and go with an open mind to try and see where this emanates from.
I think that's wonderful. But obviously, you're now here stuck in London during COVID-19. You might be doing research online and doing interviews and so on for your next book and so on, because you're working all the time, and I know that. But just here on a day-to-day level, sitting in London, where you're not in Egypt or Rwanda or Nigeria, how do you manage your unconscious biases? Not necessarily in relation to perhaps the research you're doing, because obviously you'll work much harder there, but just generally, do you have any specific tools that you follow to manage yourself?
Yes, I do. I do actually have a day job. I'm actually a chartered accountant by profession, and I'm still working in a professional service firm. So it's quite different to my work on the side, writing about sex and race. And I've attended for the organization that I work for. We do hold a number of diversity training sessions, and we're speaking about unconscious bias, race, and it's something that even very recently, give you another quick story where. If I'm honest, I was wasted. I'm a manager at the workplace in the tax firm that I work for. But I'm always kind of, I was conscious initially about unconscious bias towards Black and ethnic minorities. And I didn't realize that even, for example, because we had a test and someone was they were asking, one of the questions was, who are the people that you generally work with? Like, who are the juniors that I kind of asked if they want to help me on a particular project? And there was a theme that a lot of the people that I was picking to work with were people that I got on well with, like the whole affinity bias. So while I was complaining about, the lack of diversity, it was a trend that the people I was picking, and it wasn't that people I was choosing to work with, is people that we had things in common, like whether it's football, you speak about films, and that was something that I needed to kind of challenge and check myself. And again, it's an ongoing process, like I said. So that's something that I'm. And even when I've had like mentees, have asked me, and one in particular, there was a young lady who fresh graduate, and she was asking, especially now working from home, she just new to the firm, how does she integrate and how does she find work? And it's very difficult. It's easier, obviously, in the office because you obviously, you've got your visibility. You can do even informal things like have a coffee catch up and things like that. And I was saying that the way I've managed to develop relationships is. Even speaking about things that maybe like not to do with work, but maybe like common interests like football and things like that. When someone's familiar with you, all of a sudden it's easier to work with that person. And people build relationships differently. It might be common interests, like I said, like sports, it might be going to the pub. It's all different things, and we all do it as human beings. It's not completely fair, if I'm honest, but that's kind of like how it works. And then if
It's
you've got an
life. It's life.
that's
No, you're
life,
absolutely right.
yeah. I looked at okay, how I benefit, maybe like I said, my love of football and speak, and that's how I was able to, work with different people. And there's other interests that when I spoke to the young lady in particular, that she had a few interests and things that she could speak to other people that I couldn't connect with some people in the team. And I'll just say, use that to your ability because not everyone is going to be speaking about tax. As much as we're in tax, it's not the most interesting thing to speak about. So again, you have to think about human relationships and building human relationships and sustaining them. And that's something that I think people kind of forget about, that the human element.
I think that's so very thoughtful and absolutely spot on. And the point is that we all need to acknowledge that we will have them. You know, you will have affinity bias. You will connect with people like you, whether it's a football team or whether it's your ethnicity or whether it's something else. There will be, and that'll always be there. But it's our being aware of it and trying to be as inclusive and understanding that it's just about us as a humanity in itself. So I appreciate that a lot. Habib Akande, thank you so very much for sharing your stories of unconscious bias.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to my podcast, Between Us, Stories of Unconscious Bias. I'm Smita Tharoor. If you like this episode, please do share with a friend or colleague. It's only by sharing that more people will know of it. You can find out about previous episodes and the next ones by following me on Twitter or Instagram at Smita Tharoor. The next episode will be in a week's time.